let's begin. Do you understand your reading assignment for tomorrow? Have that for the first two discussions, then we'll be caught up. So when I call the roll, you will respond yes or no, whether you got your reading assignment done for the day. And so I've tried about some reading assignments are larger than others, but there's no way around that. Some days will be easy, some days will be harder, but it balances out. Now, the maps that you have to my left, I'm not going to move to the maps too much because I'm taping this. The top map that is the map of the Roman world. I have duplicated a map similar to this in the syllabus. We'll look at it in a few minutes. This is the world we're looking at the beginning of our study. Section 1 is the ancient Catholic Church. And I'm doing this not topically, I'm doing this by time section. We're taking a chunk of time and looking at the history of the church and the history of the world in general during for that time period. And our first time period is A.D. 30, the birthday of the church, to A.D. 323, the rise of Constantine, which is a pivotal time, a transitional period. In this period of the church, as I point out here, this is a period of when the church is born, the church begins to be persecuted, it is the church against the state and the state against the church. In A.D. 323, the end of this period, Constantine became the sole royal emperor of the Roman Empire, and he installed Christianity as the de facto religion of the state, not officially, but the functioning religion of the state. This ended the persecution and began a whole new climate, and created a whole new climate for the church. That's why I picked that date, A.D. 30 to 323. It is called the ancient Catholic Church because, for instance, if you read in Eusebius, that there is the church during this period called itself the Catholic Church, but it was not the Roman Catholic Church. You do not find much. It's difficult to say when the Roman Catholic Church started because it did not start; it evolved. But you cannot find anything by any stretch of the imagination that can be compared to the modern Roman Catholic Church until the 6th century. So you have the ancient Catholic Church, and we're going to see later what they meant by Catholic. But basically what they meant by Catholic was the true church as opposed to heretical groups or schismatic groups. You have that, when you read the New Eusebius, with the ancient sources, when they say the Catholic Church, they mean the real one. Although the word Catholic means universal, technically, the word itself. That's not what they meant by it. They meant universal secondarily, but primarily they meant the real one. This appeared the ancient Catholic Church, the ancient Orthodox Church, that is the ancient true church, as they thought of it, not the Roman Catholic Church. And by the way, let me say this, and never forget this, that in this class, when I use the term church, I use it in the historical sense, not necessarily in the biblical sense. You're going to permit me the freedom to do that, or I'll just spend the whole term qualifying. We're going to recognize the fact that we would not admit that much of what we're going to see, especially as we get through the latter part of this course, that what we're looking at is not the church in the biblical sense. We would not admit that it was a New Testament church, and I don't admit it was a New Testament church. But we're going to use the term church in Christianity, meaning historical church, historic Christianity, not committing ourselves to claiming that it's biblical Christianity. Okay? So you just, whenever I say that, I'm not suggesting it's the New Testament church. It may or may not be. Okay. Now, first of all, we come to the general situation. And this, are you with me now? We're looking at overall general situation for this whole period, this 300-year period, A.D. 30 to 323. First of all, Galatians 4:4 says, in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son. Well, that really was not only theologically true, it was geologically true, culturally true, sociologically true. Historians agree that perhaps there never was a time when the gospel could have spread so rapidly. And we're going to be looking at that as we move on. We're going to be looking at, when we look at the big picture, the mutual influence of the church and the world. Christianity did not come into a vacuum. Jesus did not come into a neutral situation. The church did not develop in a vacuum. And we're going to look at the influence of the church on the world, and we're going to look at the influence of the world on the church. The church affected the world affected the church, sometimes good, sometimes bad. We'll be looking at those things. A primary value of this course, as I point out, will be that we will be better able, after we finish this course, to identify those aspects of historic Christianity and present Christianity, which are Bible and which are simply culture. And churches really struggle with it. The church has always fought about this and struggled with this, and we struggle with it. How much, what we call Christianity, how we do things, not so much what we believe, but how we act on what we believe, how we conduct the congregational life, how much of it is cultural, how we dress, how we have the Lord's Supper, how we evangelize, and just everything. We need to be able to identify that which is Bible and that which is simply culture. And how much is culture? See, did the early church worship the way we do? You're going to find some ways yes, some ways no. Okay, and how much of what has become identified in the popular mind as Christianity is not Christianity at all? How much is it just ancient culture that's attached itself to the church, the way barnacles attach itself to a ship that as they pass by? Well, a history course will help us see. See, Cicero, the Roman historian of the first century BC, said that you either study history or remain a child. He wasn't a good historian. He didn't follow his own advice, but his advice was good. But you have a choice, either be a historian or be a child. By that he meant, if you don't know anything about history, if you don't have a concept of history, a feel for history, then history begins with your own birthday. And that's the way a child thinks. You're going to find this, that when you study history, you study everything. A historian is not a specialist. A historian is a generalist. You cannot study history by studying theology and philosophy and cultural anthropology. And you study it all, because it all happened. And nothing happened in and of itself. Nothing happened autonomously. Nothing happened in a vacuum. And so we're going to look at that and take a broad overview. One of the questions we're going to look at this is not a theology class or ecclesiology class, but if the study of history will help us to identify the first century church, then the next question is, are we supposed to duplicate the first century church? We in the Restoration movement say yes. We assume it's true, don't we? We assume that the apostolic church was the way things were supposed to be done. What they teach, we're supposed to teach. And where the basic way they carried on congregational life is the way we're supposed to. The way they organized the church, the way we're supposed to. We assume that, and I think we're right. But it's not a general assumption. Not very many assume that. It is not a moot point. It is not universally acknowledged. Many would say, no, it's the second century that's the standard. Some look at the Council of Nicaea and say, that's the theological starting place. It's Nicaea in fourth century. The Roman Catholic Church says it's whatever century you're in. You see. And we're going to say, what do you call a preacher? First century, do you have a pastor of a congregation? Well, if you want to go back to the second century, you do. What do you have if you go back to the first century? Get the point? So relevant. I'll just say this as sort of a parenthetical consideration, but it is not generally admitted among church groups and theologians. Many would not agree with us that the first century was the standard. We talk about New Testament Christianity, apostolic Christianity. The Restoration Fathers call it primitive Christianity. Well, it all comes into view. I would move on to say that when Christ was born, civilization was old and tired. It's hard for us to imagine that. But because we don't really have a sense of history, especially ancient history. Ancient history, is, even among historians, is a mystical field. We just have a hard time thinking about civilization being old and tired and worn out and over the hill when Jesus was born. We think that far back is bound to have been new. Do you realize that the pyramids were as many as 1,000 years old when Abraham saw them, 2,000 years before Christ. But the great days of Egypt not only were gone, but they've been gone and forgotten, long since gone. And I just list here in the syllabus those which had come and gone: Sumerian, Akkadian, Neo-Babylonian, Egyptian, Persian, Greco-Macedonian, of Alexander the Great, the Hittite, and Rome was on the way out. The great days of Rome were over. This part of the world over here, in the east, Asia Minor, what's now what we call the Holy Land, Israel, the great lands of the Mesopotamian Valley to the east, and Egypt, they would never be what they were. They never have been. If you go through the best cities, the best, most beautiful cities in this part of the world, look through their most highly developed sections. They look like a garbage dump compared to what they looked like 500 to 1,000 to 2,000 years before Christ. Hard for us to imagine that. The civilizations were old. The cities had fallen down pretty much. There was some revival. We're going to see that the church was born amidst one of these revivals, the Augustan revival. But people were tired. And there is in the, we find it, there was a deep-seated cynicism. There was a deep-seated longing, perhaps. When Christ was born, as I note here, there were five great civilizations on earth. We usually think of one, the Roman civilization. We read the New Testament. There were others. There was Rome, and about which included about one half of the civilized men in that day, depending on what you mean by civilized. There was the Persian or Parthian Empire, peoples to the here, Parthian Empire to the east. And Rome, it was so vast, that land was so vast and so far away from Rome, and the culture was so old that Rome never could do much. Actually, Palestine was the eastern border of the Roman Empire. They moved into the Parthian area, but they moved late, and they claimed it, but they didn't really own it. They hung up a sign and went back home. welcome to Rome. But they never did really control it. India, the great ancient empires of India were in existence when Jesus was born. The great civilizations of China and of the Americas, Central and South America. It's like in South America. South America now is thought of as backward and primitive, yet there were the day when there were great cities, great urban complexes built, various places in Central and South America. We know this, don't we? So civilization was old and tired, as we say. And there were many of them, five major ones when Jesus was born. Of course, we're interested in Rome, and I'll briefly look at the situation, Rome, and I put it in the syllabus, from republic to empire. In the century before Jesus was born, the republic had died and had dissolved into an empire. Representative government had given way to a dictatorship. And I list the major factors here. The power structure was diluted by expansion. Rome was a little city-state, and its government was set up, the Senate and the consul system, which we'll get into in the world of the New Testament, the world of the Old Testament, another class. But it was designed for a small city-state, and it was not designed for a world, and the form of government simply broke down. There was economic chaos, inflation, high interest rates, and this caused the breakdown. There was an unstable political situation in the century, in the generation before Jesus was born. There was the age of the civil wars, when Rome was crumbling and disintegrating, and therefore the people began to look to dictators like Hitler. It's analogous when Germany was on the rocks after the First World War, economic chaos, nothing worked. They looked to a dictator to make the railroads run on time. Italy did with Mussolini. And, of course, the first dictator of Rome was the famous Julius Caesar. And then his nephew, Augustus, Gaius Octavius was his name. Again, we studied this in another class in detail, but he, after defeating the enemies, after defeating those who had put Caesar to death and defeating his number one competitor for the throne of Rome, Mark Antony, at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, when he defeated the combined armies of Antony and Cleopatra, great naval battle, he became the sole dictator of the Roman Empire, and he claimed the place. He was a great man, as great Roman emperors go, and he put together. His dictatorship arose from a very unstable political situation, and last of all, moral corruption, and that speaks for itself. I've listed here in the syllabus, I kind of got ahead of myself, the inevitable rise of dictatorship. Julius Caesar, this is very important early church history, we're going to see this time and time again. Julius Caesar adopted the Oriental myth of that the emperor was God. The first Westerner to adopt this was Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great left Macedonian Greece in the 4th century B.C. as a man, the head of his armies, and he was a man until he got to Egypt. He was out, cluttered stores out in the desert, this temple in the desert, and he was lost what he was, didn't know where he was. And they knew he was, and he walked in. They fell on their faces before him and said, "You're a god." And he thought it was a good idea. It's fun being a god. So he said, "Yeah, I'm a god." He wrote back home and said, "Guess what? I'm a god." And they said, "Oh, crazy Alex is at it again." In the West over here, the idea that a man would be a god was not accepted. And the senators were not gods. They were simply wealthy, aristocratic, patrician leaders. But Julius Caesar seized upon that idea. He had the Senate declare him Jupiter Julius, God manifest, because if you're going to be a dictator, you might as well be God. People obey you better if they think you're God. And they said they voted him a God. They didn't believe it, but what do you call a man who has an army when you don't? Answer, anything he wants to be called. In this case, Jupiter Julius, so they all snickered and voted him Jupiter. But Augustus took the title, and it was a very superstitious age. He had himself declared Lord. Augustus means blessed by God, and we'll cover that also in another class. But anyway, the point is that this idea that Caesar is Lord caused the death of thousands and thousands of our brethren in the first three centuries. Who was Lord? Jesus Lord? Caesar Lord? Well, you see, the idea that Caesar is Lord was an Eastern myth that was brought to the West to try to shore up a crumbling republic, and it did for a long time. And Augustus put together the new order, and he restored the glory and power of Rome, although not as a republic, but as an empire. And you know what a republic is, don't you? Ruled by representative government. It was not a democracy, it was a republic. And he extended the borders of the empire, and you've got them in the map here. You can look at that up to the year AD 14. This was the Roman Empire. It's roughly the same as what we've got up here. What was the political situation? In the East, you had the most people, the most culture, the most wealth. Look here. Here's what you got in the first century. You had the lands of the East that were old, densely populated, wealthy, where most of the education was. Rome was on the left bank of the sea of civilization, and if you moved west of Rome, you were out in the tulips. I mean, west of Rome was the boondocks. We went north of Rome, northern Europe. West of Rome is what's now Spain and France, Portugal. When you went north into what's Germany, the Teutonic peoples, and far northwest to England, you found a bunch of people who were barbarian, warlike, vicious, crude. They had been for almost 3,000 years. The people in the East had looked upon these people as, they called them barbarians. The Greeks called them barbarians, and they were right. By the way, they were our ancestors. At this time in northern Africa, at the time when they're in northern Africa, they had been civilizations among black people, such as the ancient civilization Timbuktu, which for over two millennia had advanced civilizations, high advanced learning, built great cities. And when the black peoples of northern Africa were living high civilization, our ancestors were running through the trees, killing one another. Up in Russia, they were scalping. That's where scalping came from, by the way. The white man taught the Indian to scalp. Did you know that? Yeah, he never did it before the white man came. That's kind of anachronistic. But anyway, the Scythians did. The Germanic peoples, the Teutonic peoples, the Anglos, were just wild people, tribal society, vigorous, warlike, and only Christianity changed the verse. One of the reasons in the Middle Ages Christianity was so barbarous. There's a very deep-seated barbarism. I always laugh. Well, anyway, people talk about like the black culture, the black man's inherently backward. I'll read history. When Augustine, who was a black man, who was one of the four great theologians of the church, was doing his work, our ancestors were still essentially tribal and barbarous. And by the way, Rome did not, when it got too far east, it could not do much with these people. Rome could not do too much with the people down in Egypt and over in the far east, the ancient Mesopotamian civilization, because they considered the Romans upstarts. Their civilization was deeper and older and more immovable, more massive, and they couldn't do too much with it. never did do too much with Egypt. And they never could Latinize the peoples in the north, the barbarians, our ancestors, because we were too far the other way. That's why, for instance, Latin never became a universal language. Rome, follow me? Rome conquered the world. Alexander the Great had conquered, but Alexander the Great changed their language, but the Romans never did. That's why even though the New Testament was written in a Roman world, it was written in Greek. So, you might remember it this way. When Jesus was born, the world was wearing Roman boots, but thinking Greek thoughts, speaking the Greek language. Roman philosophy was Greek philosophy, borrowed. Roman theater was Greek philosophy, borrowed. Roman literature was Greek literature, borrowed. The only real contribution that Romans made in the area, into civilization, the only thing that the Romans were better at than the Greeks was law. We'll talk about that in a minute. There were no political barriers in the Mediterranean world. Free travel, which helped the spread of the gospel. In fact, it was easier to travel through the Mediterranean world then than it is now. Follow me, just move freely throughout the Roman world. There were 200 years of peace, more than the world's ever known since, or had known before. The progress of the gospel in its early centuries, uninterrupted by war. It's very important. A war brings a great moral decline. Remember Vietnam, the great negative moral effect it had on America? War, when war goes on, it's just a rule of life, rule of history. When war goes on, you have a growth of industry and a death of everything else. Death of morals, death of religion, death of philosophy, death of art, only machines. War, follow me, war brings about progress only in technology. And by the way, our space program, we put a man on the moon because of World War II. See? Because the technology that put the man on was German technology, which was forced through to try to save Germany. Rocket technology. Well, it's 200 years of peace, and this helped the gospel. The Romans were great road builders. You probably know this. Rome eventually was to build 250,000 miles of roads. Some of them are still used, by the way. 250,000 miles of roads. And they weren't all finished by the days of Jesus, but most of it was. Roman justice, the Roman concept of justice under law, one of the great gifts of Roman civilization. Not absolute justice, not perfect justice, but justice. We see the idea that what is right? Well, right is what the law says. Rule by law as opposed to just a pure dictatorship. Even though Rome was a dictatorship under Augustus when Jesus was born, yet he himself had to respect Roman law. Paul could invoke Roman law and have the magistrates at Philippi shaking in their boots. You have beaten the Romans, you know that? I'm a Roman citizen. We're Roman citizens, you beat us. What are you going to do now? And Paul could get out of jail by appealing to Caesar. And so this in the cultural realm we do owe to the Romans, the concept of law, justice. You often hear people say, some nitwits say that our system of law is based on the Bible. It isn't. There's no system of civil law in the Bible except the Mosaic Code of the Old Testament, which we don't use. Anybody says that, it's a stupid thing to say. We don't follow me. Our system of law is not based on the Bible. Our system of law is based on Roman law. That's why most of the terminology is Latin terminology. I'm not putting down the Bible. I'm simply saying it isn't in there. Except in the Old Testament, the Mosaic Law, and we don't use that. We don't have cities of refuge. We do have states that don't have capital punishment, but that's not as close as we come to cities of refuge. There was a common language, as I already suggested. Greek was the universal language. On the day of Pentecost, Peter preached in Greek, and everybody understood him. Speaking in tongues, by the way, was not for communication. You didn't need it. And when the New Testament was written, it was written in Greek to all over the world. You wrote in Greek to Palestine, wrote in Greek to Egypt, wrote in Greek to Asia Minor, wrote in Greek to Rome. And think what an advantage that is to preaching the gospel. Universal peace, universal language. And we'll study again with the more of the background we get in the course in in Western Civ 1. There was a underlying common culture. Even the Jews were caught up in this culture. The latest thinking among Jewish scholars, such as Martin Hengel, the German scholar, says that all Judaism was Hellenistic. The Latins were Hellenized. The common culture was sort of a Neo-Greek or a leftover Greek culture. There were few cultural barriers. People in that part of the world, the civilized world, were more like one another in different countries than they ever have been since. A common underlying culture. Again, see on the day of Pentecost, the different languages that were spoken at the baptism of the Holy Spirit. These were, for most of these people, second languages. They were the local dialects. Yet they all agreed, they all had the one language, almost all of them, surely. So an underlying common culture, that's very important. Well, we come to the intellectual situation. We'll be reminded of the problems created when the gospel moved from its Jewish context for the first 10 years of existence. The church was Jewish. You know that, don't you? The church was 10 years old before the household of Cornelius and the movement out into the Gentile world and Paul's ministry. So the church was Jewish for its first 10 years. Very important to know that. And when the gospel moved from its Jewish context into the larger world, various problems were presented. These were discussed, for instance, in Acts 15. The Great Jerusalem Conference, just study when you study the book of Acts. Cultural problems. So it's important to understand the intellectual situation. And let's look at, first of all, general conceptions. General intellectual. How do people think? These are very general. First of all, there was a belief in deity. Augustine had reopened many of the temples. He had revived temple religion. He was trying to... The political myth under which... that Augustus worked was that he was reestablishing the ancient glory of Rome, which he did in part. In order to do this, had to restore the ancient religions, the ancient gods which made Rome great. Now, he himself was not particularly religious, but it was a mythology. And so temples, and there was a great the church was born amid a sort of a revival of a Roman revival of temple worship, new attention given to the gods, but. People believed in deities, believed in God, or really in the gods. Not much skepticism, not much atheism among the common people. A lot of atheism among intellectuals. A lot of skepticism, a lot of cynicism. Spartacus, in the movie Spartacus, Charles Laughton plays a Roman senator, and he's talking to the young Julius Caesar. They're walking out of the Senate one day, and Julius is about to go on a military campaign, and he says, "I'll stop by and sacrifice." He stopped and bought a couple of birds. We're going to take it to the temple and sacrifice. And Julius says, "Well, I thought you didn't believe in the gods." And Charles Laughton says, "Well, privately I believe in none of them, publicly in all of them." And that's about the way it was. Romans sort of the public religion, but they're not. And their concept of God was very finite. Their gods were somewhere. I've said before, the average Greco-Roman god fell somewhere between Superman and the Seven Dwarfs. The gods were not the high holy gods of Judaism. When you find your chief god, Zeus, being caught in adulterous affair, caught in bed with somebody, with a goddess, by his wife Hera, and being nagged for it for eternity. When you find the gods being fooled, and the gods losing their temper, and the gods murdering one another, and the gods guilty of rape, that's the kind of god you might take down to buy a beer, but you wouldn't have to fall on your face before him. Or take him home to meet your sister. While there was not much skepticism, people believed in the gods, yet it was not a deep, heartfelt reverence for high and holy gods. It's a very important distinction. You got that? It's one thing to believe in the gods, but there's anything else to believe in. But something else to have this deep reverence for an awesome God, as the God of Israel is. And the Jews were different from the Romans in that. There was really a superstition. People were anxious to see miracles. H.B. Workman has written a book, and this is not in your syllabus. He's the author of a standard work on persecution of the church. He said this: in the second and third centuries, superstition was a growing force. From the emperor on the throne to the meanest slave, men trembled at the awful powers of the unknown, and tremble the more because of their loss of religious faith. They peopled the heavens and earth with a host of demons, believed with all their hearts, with their reliance on magicians and sorcerers. And so great prevalence of superstition. And this prevalence of superstition affected the church in at least three important ways, and I've listed them here. The superstition in everyday life, in this period, AD 30 to 323, affected the church, first of all, in that it helps explain, it explains in part, the persecution of the church. You see, the Christians were accused of offending the gods. Whenever natural calamities would occur, the Christians got blamed. And I'll give you an example here. Tertullian, in his apology, said this. He's a Christian, of course. If the Tiber rises as high as the city walls, if the Nile does not send its waters up over the fields, if the heavens give no rain, if there's an earthquake, if there's a famine or pestilence, straightway the cry is, away with the Christians, to the lion. It's sort of a standard formula. To the lion. What? Shall we give such a multitude to a single beast? You're making fun of, you know. It's a whole lot of people give to one lion. Pray tell me, how many calamities befell the world and particular cities before Tiberius reigned, before the coming, that is, of Christ? He said, didn't you ever have an earthquake? You have to hear them tell it. You never had an earthquake before Christ was born. Never had a flood. Never had a famine. But many of the local persecutions of the church came when there was a natural calamity, and they said, well, it's because we've got so many Christians in town, they've offended the gods, and so the gods are trying to tell us something, and it gave rise to persecution. You can see that, can't you? The second important way in which persecution affected the church was in the willingness of the Christians in the early centuries to believe in the miraculous. We have this today, by the way. We got a superstitious age in some ways. We say the word miracle. The word miracle, we use it all the time. We shouldn't use it. Not in the biblical sense. You know, anytime anything marvelous happens, we call it a miracle. A baby is born, that's a miracle. Oh, yeah? Is it? Well, that's a lot of sentimental slop to say so. If the birth of your baby, is it a miracle when your baby is born? It's marvelous, wasn't it? But see, if the birth of his baby was a miracle, and the birth of my baby was a miracle, what about the birth of Mary's baby? As a matter of fact, it wasn't a miracle. It wasn't a virgin birth. The birth of John the Baptist was miraculous in a different way, right? Elizabeth was past the age of childbearing. It's not a miracle, it's a marvelous. It's a providential, maybe. Your son comes up. Isn't that a miracle? No. See? So we tend to use the word miracle when we mean marvelous. Well, in extension, the ancients, they tended to interpret everything as a miracle. People like to do this. It's the sign of an ill-informed, superstitious mind. Everything's a miracle. You know, I got a job. It's a miracle. Well, it may be an answer to prayer. I got a date. That's a miracle. It may be an answer to prayer. You know, but a miracle, in the Bible, a miracle was a resurrection from the dead. That was a miracle. Feeding of the 5,000, that was a miracle. That's what miracle means. A genuine miracle, a supernatural act outside providence, outside the rules of nature. It was obviously recognized as such. Let's see. You get my point? Well, let's just be, I agree on what's marvelous and providential, but... And it's even worse in the ancient world. And we must understand this, by the way. We must remember this when we're reading the early Christian writers, the patristics, the church fathers, the apostolic fathers, the later church fathers, the post-Nicene fathers, even. Because you often read accounts of miracles in the church. And some of them seem kind of silly. I'll give you an example. Sulpicius Severus, who lived in... it's not in your syllabus, don't worry about it. AD 363 to 420, very late. He's a very sober historian. He said, you can believe me, I don't lie. And yet, in his famous work, The Life of St. Martin, which is a very important work, a very important source for the history of the church in that period, The Life of Martin of Tours, he offers as eyewitness testimony the story of how Martin resolved a problem. And here's an example. There was a grave which was thought to be the resting place of a saint. Saint worship had developed by this time, but no one was sure. Was it really the grave of a saint? Stories conflicted, and they made a great thing of, we're going to see later, of honoring the saints and
going to the graves to pray, those who died in persecutions. Remember, this was the whole period of persecution. And so Martin went there and prayed, and a ghost appeared. Lo and behold, it was the ghost of a robber who was buried there. And God, according to the story, God sent the ghost there to tell St. Martin, don't bother coming praying here. It's not a Christian martyr. It's a case of misidentification. It's really a thief buried here. So they took down the altar, and that ended that bit of saint worship. Well, you believe that? Well, I don't think God's interested enough in saint worship to send ghosts back. Well, that's the kind of story. And you read others that, you know, we'd like to believe them, but they're just so they're not. In other words, you read about miracles in the writings of the early church. I heard this happen. And these are sober men. Not anything like the miracles you read about in the scriptures. They're not highly moral miracles, reasonable miracles. They're silly miracles. The kind you read about in the apocryphal gospels. Jesus is out playing in the mud, making clay birds, throwing them up, and they're flying away. You know. See, there's miracles and there's miracles. You find many sober miracles, but you find a lot of silly, superstitious kind of miracles recorded in the writings of the early church fathers, and they look kind of out of place there. They don't have any verisimilitude, as they would say. They don't seem to fit in. But one thing to remember, this is a highly superstitious age, and people were anxious to see miracles. And by the way, there is this psychological phenomenon. You see it at faith healing meetings all the time. It's called psychological or cultural expectations. People tend to see what they expect to see, what they're told they're going to see. I went to a faith thing one time, and this faith healer told the people what he was going to see, what he was going to show them, and what he did was not what he promised at all. But those people saw it. And boy, if you asked, they'd swear on a stack of Halley's handbooks and pass a lie detector test. That's exactly what they saw, but they didn't. I was there. The reason I didn't see it was I wasn't expecting to see it. You see, well, I want to say maybe it did happen. You didn't for that reason. But what I'm saying is that they were anxious to see miracles. They called everything a miracle. And it was a very superstitious age. And as the church began to be corrupted, more of this, well, you see a lot of this still preserved in Roman Catholic doctrine. Many of the saints, people who are supposed to have lived, many of them never lived at all, performed all these stupid miracles, which were silly, you know, immoral kind of miracles, that is, not highly moral kind of miracles. And they all came from this age of superstition. And they also came from the Middle Ages, which was a very superstitious age. Does that make sense to you? Well, it helps us understand this. And the last important way in which superstition affected the church was it helps to explain the rise of saint worship. And I am not going to deal with this here. I just put this here to sort of anticipate. We're going to discuss this at length later on. So just make a note if you want to be dealt with later. But you might want to remember it here. Now we come to, as we continue our discussion of the intellectual situation, we come to particular conceptions contributed by Greek philosophy. We've looked at political situation, very, very broad terms. We looked at the intellectual situation. We're looking at the intellectual situation. We looked at religion. Now we're going to look at philosophy. Early on, in the centuries before Christ, in the 6th and 7th centuries before Christ, you recall there were the physical philosophers, such as Heraclitus and Anaxagoras. I don't think their names appear here in the syllabus. And they were men who came up with philosophies that we couldn't accept, of course. We would not be content with them. But they began a process which produced a very high philosophy. We owe a great debt to these men, and you'll see why. Such as Heraclitus, I mentioned him. Rather than explain the world as the animist, you know, might, the person who just sees the, you know, everything alive, the trees are alive and nature's alive. Heraclitus, for instance, thought of that the world was, well, these philosophers in general began to speak of explaining the world in terms of a single mind, a single principle. Maybe not God, they would sometimes call it God, but a single unifying principle. That is, we live in a universe. That's what the word universe means. It's the result of a single principle. And Heraclitus, for instance, thought of an impersonal, indwelling mind working in and through nature, a single mind in nature. And by the way, it was very close to Mother Nature. You know, I always think of Heraclitus when I read the books written by the evolutionists. They dismiss God in the prologue as a myth, and they introduce Mother Nature on page 3 as a metaphor. And what they do, what they would not allow us to do with our myth, they do with their metaphor. Nature planned this. Nature designed this. Isn't nature marvelous? Nature anticipated this. Well, Heraclitus would have loved that. He saw it within nature, a principle working from within. And then Anaxagoras said, no, there's a shaping mind from without. And this shaping mind was kind of impersonal for us. He wasn't really talking about God as we think of God, but that's a step forward, isn't it? By the way, that's this controversy between Heraclitus and Anaxagoras, follow me, is the moving creative force in nature, that which holds it together, which makes it work. Is it a force from within or a force from without? The evolutionist says it's a force from within. Nature working on its own produced everything, holds everything together. The Christian says, no, it's a force from without. It's God who created everything and sustains everything. But see, the debate was an old debate. But at least it's a step forward, isn't it? From just blind animism, blind primitivism. And so we need to realize that they contribute to the intellectual, philosophical climate. The most important man, of course, was Socrates, and we come to him now on page 5. He turned thought from the physical universe, they weren't getting very far, to man himself. He's been called the discoverer of conscience. He would agree with David Hume, for instance, that the proper study of man is man. He just focused on man. And he introduced the very important idea, and Socrates lived in a very morally degenerate age. And he introduced the idea that man, to summarize it, and I'm not going to follow the syllabus too close here, that right and wrong were sort of in the air. Right and wrong were inherent, implicit in the universe. That right and wrong, that morality was written into the constitution of the universe. And that man could discover this by reason. He could think it out. And that man could know what was right, and man could do what was right. And he was responsible to do it. You can see how that kind of thinking would prepare the world for Christianity. Can you not? We wouldn't agree with everything he said. We wouldn't agree with his definition of morality. But that basic idea is a very healthy idea, isn't it? At least it heads man in the right direction. That there is right and there is an absolute objective standard of right and wrong. And we would say it's God. He would simply say it's this sort of included in the universe. So the job of man then was to find out the right and do the right. And Christianity was later come along and say, well, no, man can know the right, but he can't do the right unless he's converted. But at least it is a very valuable contribution. Are you with me? Am I talking to myself? Well, this is in the background of Christianity. What I want us to see when Paul said in the fullness of time, there was a very popular idea in the early centuries of the church. The church fathers this way, thought this way, and I think they were at least to a measure right. They said, and we're going to find some Origen of Alexander wrote this, that what Moses was to the Jews, what Moses did for the Jews in preparing them for Christ, the philosophers did for the non-Jews in preparing them for Christ. Got that? Philo of Alexandria was cited among them. But anyway, the point is that the philosophers prepared the non-Jewish, the barbaric, as they would call it, the Greek mind. You got that? For the coming of Christ. Why would they say that? Well, this is why they would say that. And we can see why they would say it. Now, this is not saying that God purposely acted that way. We don't know that. The Bible doesn't say that, does it? The Bible doesn't say that God used Heraclitus and Anaxagoras and the other physical philosophers, and that God used Plato and Socrates and Aristotle. It doesn't say that. But when we look at their ideas and how they did prepare the mind of man for Christianity, the idea of a single force from without who creates and guides, the idea of learning the right and doing the right and being responsibility for high morality, these are good ideas, aren't they? Progressive ideas. And so for this and other reasons, the early church fathers thought this way. And again, we can't prove it, I think they were right. I think God was using these men to prepare Christ to come in the fullness of time. Now, I can't prove it. I don't feel like I have to. It's not important to. At least it happened that way for the same reason. Because I believe that God used Socrates to prepare the mind of man for the coming of Christ, just like God used Augustus to prepare the roads and the land and the judicial system and the climate of peace. It's like I believe God used Alexander the Great to give us a universal language. See, all things were ready for the spreading of the gospel. That's why, for instance, by the time in the late first century when Rome got around, woke up and realized what a threat the church was to it, it was too late. Took the gospel in one. They took the world in one generation. Almost. Why? Everything was ready. Jesus didn't just stumble into history. And circumstantial evidence. You follow me? The Bible doesn't say that, but I like the idea anyway. Makes sense. Well, we've got a good stopping place here. We'll say another word about Socrates. We're not quite at the end of this. Got a little bit more to say on this section, but we will try to get through discussion 2 tomorrow. So be sure and have your reading done.